saving money in your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need for keeping your outdoor power equipment in tip-top shape. Ensure your lawnmower or boat is running smooth this year. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale. View our entire selection of FVP batteries today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of the great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody, and tonight I have a double feature for you, with a couple of stories bubbling up from the murky depths of the internet. To open, we'll be reading Never Play a Game Called Corpse Hold by Craig Groshek, in which our protagonist unknowingly changes the course of his life after giving in to some peer pressure. After that, we have Miranda Liked to Lie on the Internet by Nikki Exposito, where we get an object lesson on how dangerous and insidiously vast the internet can be. Folks, I particularly enjoyed both of tonight's stories, so kick back, tune out the screams coming from your cellar, and join me in the darkness. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Craig Groshek, I give you Never Play a Game Called Corpse Hold. If you ever hear about a game called Corpse Hold, don't play it. I mean it. There are some things in this world you don't mess with, and this is one of them. It doesn't matter what you're promised or how much you want to impress your friends. It's not worth what happens if you fail, or worse, if you succeed. I wish someone had told me that before I learned it the hard way. I grew up in a little town in Arkansas. You probably wouldn't find it on a map unless you knew where to look. It was one of those places where there wasn't much to do except fish, swim, or poke around the woods until you stumbled on something interesting. Or dangerous. The rivers and ponds around my hometown were like veins running through the area, feeding everything and everyone. They were muddy, still, and full of secrets. Secrets best kept buried. Every town has its share of weird stories, and ours was no different. There were tales of ghost lights over the swamps, the occasional Bigfoot sighting, and, of course, the game Corpse Hold. That was the one everyone whispered about, but no one admitted to knowing too much about. At least, not until you were old enough to be trusted. The rules of the game were simple but horrifying. You were supposed to find a witness, someone who'd done it before. Then, under their supervision, you go out to a particular pond after dark, wade into the water, and touch a corpse that supposedly lay at the bottom. Not just touch it, though. Both hands had to stay on the body for a full hour. No breaks, no pulling away, no excuses. If you messed up, you had to start over. The legend says the corpse never decomposes, no matter how long it's been there. People whispered that it was decades old, maybe more, but no one seemed to know where it came from or why it stayed preserved. The kids who'd done it swore by its power, claiming it brought them wealth, luck, and protection. But there were just as many stories about the ones who'd failed, how they'd been cursed, gone missing, or died in gruesome ways. I always thought it was just a stupid urban legend, a way for older kids to scare the younger ones or keep them out of the woods at night. I even laughed about it with my friends, saying things like, "Yeah, I'll play it when pigs fly." But when I turned 13, everything changed. One summer night, I was hanging out at the old baseball diamond with some of the neighborhood kids. It was one of those humid nights where the air sticks to your skin and the mosquitoes are relentless. We were talking about nothing in particular when Eddie, one of the older boys, leaned in close and said, "You ever hear about Corpse Hold?" Everyone went quiet. Even the bugs fell silent for a second. "Yeah," I said, trying to sound casual. "What about it?" Eddie smirked. "You think you got what it takes to play?" I laughed, nervously. "What, you mean touching some dead guy for an hour? Sounds like a joke." "It's not a joke," Eddie said, his voice suddenly serious. "It's real, and if you've got the guts, we can take you tonight." The others started chiming in, some goading me on, others looking uneasy. I could feel the group closing in, their expectations weighing on me. I didn't want to seem scared or weak, but something about the way Eddie said it sent a chill down my spine. "What happens if I don't?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. Eddie shrugged. "Nothing, but you'll always wonder what could have been." He said it like he knew something I didn't, like there was a secret only people who played the game could understand. That's what did it for me. It wasn't the promise of fortune or luck. It was the idea that I might miss out on something big. I nodded. "All right, let's do it." The group broke into cheers and jeers, slapping me on the back and congratulating me like I just won a prize. But I didn't feel like a winner. I felt like a mouse walking into a trap. We met later that night at the edge of the woods, where the dirt trail to the pond began. Eddie was waiting there with the others, Sammy, Kyle, Mark, and Maria. They were older than me by a year or two, the kind of kids who made you want to act braver than you actually were. They had flashlights, snacks stuffed into their backpacks, and a confidence that didn't quite match the uneasiness in their eyes. Eddie handed me a flashlight. "You ready for this?" I nodded, but my stomach was in knots. The trail was narrow, cutting through tall grass and clusters of trees. Every snap of a twig made me jump, but the others just kept walking, their flashlights bouncing in the dark like fireflies. Nobody talked much. It was as if the gravity of what we were about to do was sinking in for everyone, even the ones who'd done it before. "What's the deal with this pond, anyway?" I asked, breaking the silence. "Why there?" Maria glanced over her shoulder.
"Because that's where he is."
"He?"
"The corpse,"
she said, like it was obvious.
"You'll see."
That shut me up for a while. The pond appeared suddenly, framed by trees like a dark mirror. The air was cooler here, with a dampness that clung to my skin. Eddie pointed his flashlight at the still black water, the beam cutting through the surface, but not revealing much.
"All right," Eddie said, turning to me. "Here's how this works."
The group circled around, their faces grave. Even Kyle, who was usually cracking jokes, appeared solemn. "Rule one," Eddie began.
This has to happen at night. No exceptions. It's the only time he's active. I swallowed hard. Active how? You'll find out, Eddie said, brushing off my question. Rule 2. You have to keep both hands on the corpse at all times. No breaks, no pulling away. If you lose contact, you start over. Sammy chimed in. And trust me, you don't want to do that. Rule 3, Eddie continued. There has to be a witness, someone who's already done it. That's me. And rule 4, you don't back out. Once you start, you finish. Failure is not an option. The way he said it sent a shiver down my spine. It wasn't just a warning. It was a threat. What happens if I back out? I asked, my voice quieter than I meant it to be. Eddie didn't answer right away. He just stared at me, his expression bleak. You don't want to know. I looked at the others, hoping for some reassurance. They just stood there, silent and unmoving. Before I could ask anything else, the group started wading into the pond. The water was colder than I expected, soaking through my jeans and shoes as we moved deeper. It came up to my waist before Eddie stopped and turned his flashlight toward the middle of the pond. At first, I didn't see anything, just water rippling under the light. Then, he appeared. A man, whom I'd never seen before and who no one had mentioned, crept out of the shadows at the far end of the pond like he'd been waiting there all along. He was tall and thin, with a face that was too pale and eyes that didn't reflect the light. I glanced over at Eddie, expecting him to be as nervous as I was, but he wasn't. Instead, he appeared calm and unbothered. His expression said it all. He was expecting this. What's going on? I asked, my confidence wavering. Eddie, you're seeing this, right? He didn't answer. Reluctantly, I turned my attention back to face the man. His clothes were soaked, clinging to his bony frame, and he was grinning, an unsettling sort of smile that made my stomach drop. Who's this? The stranger asked, his voice low and gravelly. Eddie stepped aside, motioning to me. He's the one. The man nodded, then waded toward me with slow, deliberate movements. The water barely rippled around him, like it didn't dare touch him more than it had to. When he reached me, he extended a hand. I hesitated, but Eddie nudged me forward. Take it. I did. His grip was cold and firm, like holding onto a fistful of icicles. He led me deeper into the pond, his other hand gripping my shoulder to steady me. Don't move, he said, stopping abruptly. Then he plunged his arm into the water. The sound of it made my chest tighten, a wet, sucking noise as his hand disappeared beneath the surface. For a moment, nothing happened. Then he pulled, and the corpse came into view. The man pulled with slow, steady force, and the corpse emerged from the black water. I don't know what I expected, maybe something bloated or skeletal, but this wasn't like that. The body looked intact. Its skin was pale and rubbery, stretched tightly over its frame like it had been dipped in wax. Its clothes were old-fashioned, suspenders and a button-up shirt that clung wetly to its chest. Its eyes were closed, its mouth slightly open, and its hair, dark and slick, was plastered to its head. How is it not rotting? I whispered. Doesn't rot, Eddie said behind me. His voice sounded far away, like he didn't want to be any closer than he had to be. The man, no one ever told me his name, if he even had one, placed both of his hands under the corpse's arms, holding it upright. The water lapped gently against its torso, the only sound in the suffocating quiet. Step forward, the man said. My legs felt like they'd turned to stone. Every instinct screamed at me to run, to get out of that water and never come back. But Eddie was standing behind me, and when I glanced back, his expression was firm. There was no way I was backing out now. I took a shaky step closer, and the man guided my hands toward the corpse's chest. The second I touched it, I regretted everything. The skin was ice cold, slimy but firm, with the texture of wet rubber. My stomach churned, and I had to bite the inside of my cheek to keep from gagging. "Both hands," the man said. I placed my other hand on the corpse, my palms flat against its chest. The water rippled around us, and I swear I felt something shift beneath my palms. "Keep them there," the man continued. "Don't move, no matter what." I nodded, too scared to speak. "Your hour starts now," Eddie called from the shore. The first few minutes passed in agonizing silence. The corpse didn't move, but the sensation of touching it was unbearable. My hands were stiff and numb, and my mind was racing, conjuring every horror story I'd ever heard about spirits, curses, and the vengeful dead. I tried to distract myself by focusing on the sounds around me, the croak of frogs, the buzz of insects, the occasional rustling of leaves. But the stillness of the pond was oppressive, and every tiny sound felt amplified. Then came the whispers. At first, I thought it was the wind, but I was wrong. They were words, low and guttural, spoken in a language I didn't recognize by someone or something that wasn't human. And even as they grew clearer, I couldn't understand them. I glanced at the man, but he didn't react. His focus was entirely on the corpse, his pale eyes unblinking. "Do you hear that?" I asked, my voice trembling. He didn't answer. My hands began to cramp, and I shifted my weight, trying to stay steady in the water. As the minutes crawled by, the whispers grew louder and more insistent. They weren't coming from the man or from Eddie. They were coming from the corpse. "Stay still," the man said sharply, his voice cutting through the whispers. I froze. Somewhere around the halfway mark, something changed. The corpse shifted. It was subtle at first, a slight movement beneath my hands, like a muscle twitching. I told myself it was just my imagination, that the cold, the water, and the darkness were playing tricks on me. But then it moved again, stronger this time. Its chest rose slightly, as if taking a breath. I panicked and jerked my hands away. "No!" the man barked, his voice louder than I'd thought possible. "Put them back, now!" My heart pounded as I slapped my hands back onto the corpse. It felt different this time, though. Colder, heavier, almost like it was leaning into me. "Do not break contact again," the man warned. Eddie called out from the shore. "You're back at the start! Keep going!" I wanted to scream at him, to tell him I was done. But something about the man's stare kept me rooted in place. There was no escape now. The second attempt was worse. The whispers grew louder, a maddening cacophony of disembodied voices carried on the wind. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying to block them out, but they burrowed into my mind, relentless and alien. All the while, the corpse continued to twitch, moving in small but deliberate ways that made my skin crawl. At one point, its fingers brushed my arm, and I nearly lost it. My legs trembled, and I clenched my teeth so hard I thought they might crack. "Almost there," the man said. "Whatever you do, do not let go." I didn't respond. I couldn't. When Eddie finally called out, "Time's up!" I didn't believe him. It felt like the hour had stretched into eternity. The man gently pulled my quivering hands away from the corpse, and for the first time in what felt like forever, I took a deep breath. Delirious, I stumbled back toward the shore, barely able to keep my footing in the water. The man didn't follow. He stayed beside the corpse, his pale eyes watching me until I reached the others. Congratulations, Eddie said, clapping me on the back. You did it! I didn't feel like I'd won anything. I was barely out of the water, my legs shaking and my chest heaving, when the next kid stepped forward. His name was Mark, and I could tell he didn't want to play the game. His face was pale, his lips pressed into a thin line, but Eddie clapped him on the back and muttered something I couldn't hear. Mark gave a short nod, though his hands trembled as he stepped into the pond. The man was still standing in the water, a corpse floating upright beside him as if tethered there by some invisible force. He motioned for Mark to come closer, and Mark hesitated, his steps faltering. "Come on," Eddie said sharply from behind me. "You agreed to this." Mark glanced back at us, his eyes wide with fear, but he kept moving. When he reached the corpse, the man grabbed his wrists and pressed his hands onto its chest, just like he'd done with me. "Don't move," the man said, his voice low and stern. Mark nodded, swallowing hard. The first few minutes were uneventful. Mark stood there with his hands on the corpse, his shoulders tense and his breathing shallow. Eddie and the others watched from the shore, their expressions unreadable. I stayed silent, my legs still feeling like jelly. But then the whispers started again. I could see it in Mark's face, the way his eyes darted around like he was trying to figure out where the sounds were coming from. His fingers twitched involuntarily against the corpse's chest. "Do you hear that?" he asked, his voice shaky.
"Focus!"
the man snapped. Mark flinched, but didn't let go. The whispers grew louder, and I could see the panic building in Mark's eyes. He started to shift his weight from foot to foot, his movements becoming more erratic. Then, the corpse moved. Its arm twitched, just a small jerk at first, but enough to make Mark freeze. He stared at it, his mouth opening and closing like he wanted to say something but couldn't find the words. Another twitch, this time in its fingers.
"Nope,"
Mark said, shaking his head.
"I'm out."
"Don't,"
the man growled, but Mark was already backing away. The corpse's hand shot out, gripping Mark's wrist. Mark screamed, a high-pitched, panicked sound that sent chills down my spine. He tried to pull away, but the corpse's grip was unyielding. The man didn't move to help. He just stood there, watching with an expression that was disturbingly calm.
"Let go!"
Mark shouted, yanking his arm back with all his strength. The corpse's grip broke, and Mark stumbled backward, falling into the water. He scrambled back to his feet, his eyes wild.
"I said I'm done!"
he yelled, backing away toward the shore.
"I'm not doing this!"
The man's expression darkened, but he said nothing as Mark splashed past him and bolted out of the water. The rest of us stood in stunned silence as Mark grabbed his shoes and ran into the woods, disappearing down the trail. Eddie cursed under his breath, shaking his head. "He shouldn't have done that," Maria said quietly. "What happens now?" I asked, my voice barely above a whisper. No one answered. The man waded back toward the center of the pond, the corpse following him like a loyal dog. He sank into the water until only his head was visible, then disappeared completely, leaving the pond still and silent once again.
"Let's go," Eddie said, his voice tight. "We're done here."
We packed up in silence and made our way back through the woods. The weight of what had just happened hung heavy in the air, and no one spoke. The next day, I found out what happens when you break the rules. Mark's body was discovered near the riverbank, about a mile from the pond. The official story was that he drowned, but the details didn't add up. His body was bloated, his skin pale and slick, like it had been submerged for days. His arm, the one the corpse had grabbed, was bent at an unnatural angle, the skin dark and mottled. Eddie pulled me aside at school, a stern expression on his face. "Don't say anything about last night," he warned. "Not to anyone. Got it?" I nodded, too frightened to argue. The whispers about Mark's death spread quickly, but no one mentioned Corpse Hold. The group acted like nothing had happened, but I could see the fear in their eyes. We all knew the truth, even if we didn't say it out loud. That night, I couldn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw the corpse's hand gripping Mark's wrist, its pale, lifeless fingers digging into his skin. I heard his screams, the splashing of water, the whispers in the dark. I thought about the man, how he disappeared into the pond like he was part of it, like he belonged there. And I thought about Mark, about the look on his face when he ran, when he broke the rules. I realized then that there was no escaping Corpse Hold. Once you played, you were in it for life, whether you won or lost. I didn't leave my house for the next few days. I couldn't. Every time I thought about stepping outside, my chest tightened and my legs felt like they were locked in place. I kept replaying the events at the pond in my head. The corpse's cold, rubbery skin, the whispers that had embedded themselves in my head, the way Mark had screamed as the thing clutched his arm. I thought the fear would fade, but it didn't. If anything, it got worse. At night, I'd lie awake, staring at the ceiling, my ears straining to pick up sounds that weren't there. I began to notice small things, shadows that seemed to move when I wasn't looking, strange creaks in the floorboards. I felt like I was being surveilled. My parents chalked it up to nerves. They thought I was just upset about Mark's death, which made sense. Everyone in town was talking about it, how he'd been found by the river, how the sheriff thought it was an accident, how tragic it was to lose someone so young. But I knew the truth, and it was eating me alive. Eddie and the others acted like nothing had happened. When I saw them at school, they smiled, laughed, and carried on like normal. But when I caught Eddie's eyes, I saw it, the same fear I felt. He didn't say anything to me, but his expression was clear. Don't talk about it. Don't even think about it. About a week after the ritual, things started to change. It was subtle at first. I found a $20 bill on the sidewalk on my way home from school. I aced a math quiz I hadn't studied for. The neighbor's dog, who usually barked at me, wagged his tail and let me pet him. At first, I thought it was just a coincidence, but then it kept happening. My mom won a raffle at the grocery store, $500 in gift cards. My dad's old truck, which had been acting up for months, suddenly started running like new. And me? I couldn't lose. Every test, every game, every little thing I tried my hand at, it all went my way. I should have been happy. I should have felt like it was all worth it. But I didn't. The luck didn't feel like mine. It felt borrowed, like it could be taken away at any moment. And no matter how much good came my way, the dread never subsided. One night, I woke up to a sound outside my window. It wasn't loud, just a faint tapping, like fingernails against glass. I froze. Slowly, I turned my head, expecting to see a tree branch or a bird. There was nothing there, just darkness. The tapping stopped, but the feeling didn't go away. I lay there for hours, too terrified to move, until the first light of dawn crept through the blinds. The next day, I ran into Eddie after school. He pulled me aside, away from the others, and lowered his voice. "You've noticed it, haven't you?" he asked. "Noticed what?" "The way things feel different." I hesitated. "You mean the luck?" Eddie nodded. "Yeah, but it's not just that. It's like something's always there, watching, waiting." I didn't want to admit it, but he was right. "What happens now?" I asked. Eddie shrugged. "You keep your mouth shut and you hope for the best." "That's it?" "That's all you can do," he said, his tone grim. You think this is over just because you finished the game? It's never over. I tried to put his words out of my mind, but they stuck with me. Everywhere I went, I felt it. Even when things went right, it felt wrong, like I was being rewarded for something I didn't deserve. Then, one afternoon, I saw Maria walking home from school. She was alone, her face pale and drawn. Maria! I called out, jogging to catch up with her. She stopped and turned, her eyes wide. What? Have you felt it too? I asked. The watching? She nodded, slowly, glancing over her shoulder. It doesn't stop. It never stops. Why don't we tell someone? I asked. What if we... No, she said sharply, cutting me off. You don't tell anyone. You don't even think about telling anyone. Do you understand? Her voice trembled, and for the first time, I saw tears in her eyes. Why not? I pressed. Because they'll know, she whispered. They'll come for you, and you won't be so lucky anymore. That night, I dreamed about the pond. I saw the man standing in the water, his pale eyes locked on mine. The corpse was beside him, his face turned toward me, its mouth moving soundlessly. I woke up drenched in sweat, the whisper still echoing in my ears. The next morning, I found another $20 bill on my way to school. A few weeks passed, and the good fortune kept on coming. My family's broken air conditioner seemingly repaired itself overnight. A distant uncle I barely knew sent me a birthday card with a crisp $100 bill inside, even though it wasn't my birthday. Little things like that kept happening, one after another, until I could no longer ignore the pattern. But the feeling of being monitored remained. Sometimes, late at night, I'd hear faint whispers coming from nowhere, just like the ones at the pond. I'd tell myself it was the wind or maybe the house settling, but deep down, I knew better. Things were escalating. One night, I decided to confront Eddie about it. I waited until after school, catching him as he was unlocking his bike. Eddie, I said, keeping my voice low. I need to know, what's the deal with the game? The man, the thing in the pond? Eddie looked around quickly, making sure no one else was listening, then sighed. Trust me, you don't want to know. I think I deserve to know, I said. He hesitated, then nodded. Fine, but you can't ask me about this again, ever. We sat at the edge of the school parking lot, far enough away from everyone else. Eddie glanced around one more time before speaking. They say the corpse has been there for decades, maybe longer. No one knows how it got there or why it doesn't decompose. Some think it's cursed. Others think it's something else. Like what? I asked. Something inhuman, Eddie said flatly. I felt a chill run through me. And the man? He's always been part of it, Eddie continued. Every group that's ever played the game talks about him, but no one knows who he is. Some people think he's a spirit, like the corpse. Others think he's just a man. But whatever he is, he's tied to the pond. He never leaves. I thought about the way the man had disappeared into the water, how he'd seemed to sink without a trace, and I shivered. What happens if you back out? I asked. You saw what happened to Mark, Eddie said. Yeah, but why? Eddie stared at me for a long moment before answering. Corpse Hold is more than a game. It's a ritual. And when you start it, you make a deal. If you follow the rules, you get what you were promised. But if you break them... He didn't finish the sentence. He didn't have to. That night, again, I couldn't sleep. Eddie's words swirled in my head, mixing with the memories of the pond, the corpse, and the man. I kept trying to make sense of it, but the more I thought about it, the less sense it made. I remembered something Maria had said after Mark's death. They'll know. They'll come for you. Who were they? The whisper started again, faint but insistent. I squeezed my eyes shut and pulled the blanket over my head, trying to block them out. You finished the game, I thought. You followed the rules. You're safe. But I didn't feel safe. The next morning, I decided to go back to the pond. I didn't tell anyone where I was going. I just grabbed a flashlight and headed out. The trail felt longer this time, the trees darker, the air heavier. When I arrived, I stopped at the edge, staring at the still water. It looked the same as before, but felt, well, it felt different. I stepped into the water, wincing as the cold seeped through my shoes. The surface rippled around me as I waded deeper, my flashlight beam cutting through the blackness.
Who are you?
I called out, my voice shaking.
Tell me what you want.
No one answered. But then, just as I was about to turn back, the whispers started again, louder this time, clearer. I stumbled back, nearly losing my footing. My flashlight flickered, and for a split second, I thought I saw something. Two pale eyes staring at me from beneath the surface. I didn't wait to see more. I turned and ran, splashing through the water and up the trail. When I got home, I locked my bedroom door and sat on my bed, trembling. That was the last time I went to the pond. I didn't tell Eddie or Maria what I'd done. I didn't tell anyone. But I knew one thing for certain. Corpse Hold isn't just a game. It's something ancient and otherworldly. And I had been stupid enough to get involved. Now, I can only hope the whispers will fade, that the eyes will stop watching. But deep down, I know they won't. Because once you hold the corpse, you can never let go. You've been listening to Never Play a Game Called Corpse Hold by Craig Groshek. Craig Groshek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, which has grown to nearly 500,000 subscribers, over 3,000 uploads, and more than 69 million video views in its 12 years of operation. He also oversees production of 4 weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, including this one, faithfully adapting and featuring the work of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his short stories have been adapted for this channel and other platforms. He holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. In his free time, Groshek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with 3 horror-loving children and his friends. Now, to close out our episode, here's Miranda Liked to Lie on the Internet by Nikki Exposito. Draco Bissus Torta. I like to describe them as the Manson family if Charlie was considerably more organized. Their favorite hobbies include disemboweling animals and setting trash fires, always with their calling card, a tower with a dragon wrapped around it. They say they're possessed, that the Nephilim make them do it. Weird cultists. They're like the Hydra in Greek mythology. We arrest one, and 3 more spring up in their place. Detective L. Romero, LAPD, June 2010. Miranda Liddell liked to lie on the internet. In 2002, the beginning of our sophomore year, our entire social circle was obsessed with LiveJournal. My live journal filled a void in me I hadn't known existed. I'd express my opinions about the war in Afghanistan, stem cell research, and how I would have voted for Ralph Nader in the 2000 election if I were old enough to vote, and people read what I wrote and responded to it. I communicated with other kids who were obsessed with Pokemon and geeked out over Lord of the Rings. I even became internet friends with a couple boys my age who'd come out of the closet as openly gay. Baby steps. A LiveJournal friend, Killahawk15, who I talked to on AIM, told me about another LiveJournal user whose father was a higher-up in the CIA. This girl claimed to be a cadet at a special high school for future spies. She hinted at secret knowledge of government conspiracies and told stories about posing as a decoy to trap sex traffickers and expose terrorist cells. "She's not lying," Killahawk15 typed. "She told us the Enron guys were going to get arrested like a month before it happened." "What's her name?" I asked. "CosmicBlonde87. I looked up the page myself, then called Miranda. She was CosmicBlonde87. She'd used the same handle for her old Pokemon Blue version. The LiveJournal page, on which she described a mission to infiltrate a sale of uranium by the Taliban to the Iraqi Republican Guard, clearly showcased her writing style. Miranda just laughed. "You caught me. Are you going to tattle?" "What? No," I stammered. "Why are you pretending you're Kim Possible? And how did you know about Enron?" Miranda laughed again. "I watch CNN, Skylar, and I read the papers. Not just the part about how Winona got caught shoplifting. The entire thing. Like the financial pages. Anyone who reads the papers could have seen the Enron mess coming like a meteor." "Oh," I responded, feeling stupid. I'd never even heard of Enron until the bankruptcy was on the nightly news. "So, when you said George W. Bush secretly allowed for oil drilling in Roswell and they found alien skeletons..." "Oh my God, Skylar, I lied." I could hear Miranda rolling her eyes. "Most of that account is just shit I made up. The trick is to throw in just the right amount of reality. If I'm right one time out of, like, 10, people believe anything I say." My current self, the nearly 40-year-old adult, would have thought a little more critically about how much Miranda enjoyed manipulation and deceit. But teenaged me let it go. When it came to Miranda, I let a lot of things go. Miranda and I met sophomore year on the benches in front of Morrison Preparatory School. We were reading the same book, Empire Falls by Richard Russo, if you're curious, and became immediate best friends. My family moved from a small town outside Pittsburgh to Pasadena, California, the summer before my sophomore year. I was soon slapped in the face with a rough reality. In my new life, I was average. Back home, I'd been the star of the baseball team. At Morrison, I kept the bench warm. Back home, I earned such good grades with so little effort, I'd cultivated a reputation as a genius. At Morrison, the academically cutthroat Thunderdome, I received my first C. I'd once hung out with the popular group, but as the new kid at Morrison, I struggled to embed myself into already established cliques. I only knew one kid who lived in the area, Kyle Watts. Kyle, my first love, Kyle. We'd been cabin mates at summer baseball camp. Kyle lived in Glendale and attended St. Vincent School for Boys, an unofficial brother school of Morrison. Kyle, with perfectly tousled auburn hair and a crooked smile, who'd do anything for a laugh and couldn't stand to see anyone in pain. Then there was that night behind the mess hall, his soft lips on mine, his mouth tasting like chocolate cookies. Since that summer ended, Kyle had ignored my emails, my AIM messages, my phone calls, and handwritten letters. Before we moved, I emailed him one last time. I told him where we'd be living, where I'd be going to school. Yet again, radio silence. I was as invisible to Kyle as I was to my new classmates at Morrison Prep. Then I met Miranda, and my life changed. Miranda was beautiful. She was brilliant, second in our class. She played the lead in drama club productions, sang solos with the choir, ran track, wrote for the school paper, and copy-edited the yearbook. She'd risen so far above high school drama it barely registered on her radar, and because of her glowing self-confidence, girls flocked to her like moths to a flame. A rumor got around that Miranda and I were dating. We didn't deny it, and suddenly, I was as popular as she was. May of our junior year, Miranda and I got ready together before Brett Walensky's birthday party. Miranda was an only child. She lived in an old house off Orange Grove with her widowed grandmother, her father's mother. Miranda's own mother died of complications shortly after she'd given birth to Miranda. Christine Liddell had been a painter. Her colorful, dramatic work was framed all over the house. Miranda's favorite piece, hung in her room, depicted a starkly realistic prison tower with a fantastical dragon wrapped around it. She never spoke about her father, and I never asked. Miranda squealed when I found her in her room. She jumped up from her desk, she'd been typing something on her computer, announced she had a surprise for me, and rushed out of the room. I plopped down on her fat beanbag chair. A second later, her iMac chirped. Then again, and again. I got up to look, thinking Miranda might be getting AIM messages from Danny, the Morrison senior giving us a ride to the party. I was right about AIM, but not Danny. The messages were from someone with the screen name Corey Brown 86. Corey Brown 86. I got your pics. Corey Brown 86. I choked it to your tits. Corey Brown 86. You're a very bad girl. Detention tonight. Wear your school uniform and red panties, winky face.
Skylar, don't look at that!
Miranda pushed me aside and closed the chat window.
Who is that guy?
I demanded.
He might be a 40-year-old pervert.
Miranda smiled mischievously. He's a 46-year-old tax attorney and the president of Good Shepherd Church. His real name's Bob Gibbs. I gaped. All those assemblies, all the after-school specials played out in my head like a choose-your-own-adventure book. I saw Miranda tied up in the trunk of a greasy old Honda. Miranda, pregnant and sleeping under the 210. Miranda, chained in a torture basement, the 46-year-old president of Good Shepherd Church looming over her. Miranda noticed the look on my face and got serious. I'm just using him, Skylar. I send him pictures, he wires me money. Money I used for this. She pulled my surprise out of the pocket of her laced-up jeans. Two fake IDs. Good quality fake IDs. One with my name, one with hers. Birth year on both, 1982. I screeched excitedly, bouncing up and down like a little kid at Disneyland. I forced myself to bury what I'd learned, that my best friend was sending nude photos to a middle-aged pedophile, that instead of doing the right thing and turning him into the authorities, she'd exploited the situation to extort money. Adult me wants to scream at my teenaged self. It was March of my senior year when I first heard the name Draco Bissus Torta. I was AIM chatting with Amber Yen, a friend who went to St. Agnes School for Girls. We'd met in an art class and bonded over our love of Samurai Champloo and Miyazaki films. Willow Rose 924.
Dude, you gotta check this out. Draco Bissus Torta. There's a chat room where a bunch of guys are going on about it.
PA Kaunashi 020.
Sounds like the villain from an 80s video game.
Willow Rose 924.
It's a secret society, and they're like recruiting new members.
PA Kaunashi 020. I call BS. All I knew about secret societies I'd learned from the Da Vinci Code. And I knew Amber. She was a conspiracy theory nut. MK Ultra, aliens built the pyramids, subliminal messaging and breakfast cereal ads. She'd believe anything presented as a hidden truth, which, ironically, made her pretty gullible.
Willow Rose 924. This is their website, www.dracobissustorta.com.
The website was simple and ugly. Gray background, title in a large font, Times New Roman text. A box in the upper left corner counted page views. 59 of them. And below the title, a crude drawing of a tower with a dragon wrapped around it.
Allow us to introduce ourselves. We live amongst you, but we are not of you. We have seen your reality for what it truly is. A fragile, gossamer spider's web blowing in the winds of the cosmic eternity. You are like the blind man chained to the rock. Because you see shadows, you think yourselves wise. We are the ones who have broken free. Come and find us. you will be free as well. 34 children dance just beyond the trees. 32 arms twist in purple leaves. Their pretty golden eyes are filled with tears. Black mold grows on 118 ears. Behind on the cliffs, there's pink glowing rays, a smiling sun for only one day. Tell them a secret and they might reveal. Reach all the way down until their hands you feel. I rolled my eyes and messaged Amber back. PA Kaunashio 20. Sounds like a bunch of pretentious douchebags. Willow Rose 924. Check out the chat room. They think the poem's a clue. Like, if you figure it out, I don't know, something'll happen. I had better things to do with my night, like study for the physics test Mr. Kander promised would be a ball buster. But I couldn't resist copying and pasting the long address Amber sent me into my search bar, then clicking add. Warlord 8585. Stop obsessing over the colors, dumb shit. It's the numbers. 4 is about the elements. 5 is the 5 senses. Louis de 17th. Ooh, did you ask Jeeves, big shot? Trinity Jane 123. The Egyptians believed that gold gave you safe passage into the afterlife? Angels fan 86. You guys are making too much hay over the secret, esoteric meaning of things. Look at the numbers themselves. It might be an address we need to go to. They did say come find us. Louis de 17th. Okay, idiot, you go to every address that number could mean. We'll be here using more than one brain cell. PA Kaunashio 20. I think the guy who said address is right. Map coordinates, maybe? I logged out and turned off my computer. The guy who said address was definitely right. I'd solved the little riddle, decoded the clue. I'd figured out where Draco Bissus Torta hid. Actually, I could do one better. I knew the hidden truth about who Draco Bissus Torta actually was. I see those Draco Bissus Torta guys on 4chan all the time, Reddit, wherever there's a lot of kids. They post these dumb little rhymes, supposedly to recruit new members. I just ignore them. My mom says they're a death cult. Alex L., age 15, October 2014. I don't get it, Miranda, I insisted. What's the game here? You're starting your own fake internet cult? Miranda sat cross-legged on her bed. Even in sweaty running shorts, she looked impossibly beautiful with her ice-blonde mane, heart-shaped face, Renaissance sculpture figure, and sparkling gray eyes. She grinned at me, her mischievous Mona Lisa smile, the one that reduced prep school boys to mush and kept me following after her like a dopey duckling. It's not fake, Skylar, she said. So you're starting a real cult? Based around that picture you have on the wall. I pointed to her mother's framed artwork, the beautiful dragon coiled around the tower, the crude mimicry of which decorated the bottom of the Draco Bissus Torta website. Miranda snorted. That's what tipped you off? I nodded. Her smile faded. Okay, fine, she said. I made the website, but it's based on a real secret society. My dad used to be the leader of a magical club called Draco Bissus Torta. He was a physicist at JPL. They only accepted the most brilliant as members. Your dad was a scientist, but also Harry Potter? Miranda had never so much as mentioned her father as an entity. Not like Harry Potter. Draco Bissus Torta, they communicated with these half-angel creatures called Nephilim, who were banished to another plane of reality. Draco Bissus Torta let the Nephilim wear them, like possess them, and in exchange, the Nephilim told them secrets about the future. I wanted to laugh. This all sounded like a rejected episode of Buffy, but Miranda's face was dead serious. She kicked out her legs, rolled off her bed, went to her writing desk, and pulled an old leather-bound book out of a drawer, which she offered to me. I thumbed through pages of jagged cursive. I found his journal, she said, cleaning out the attic. He disappeared when I was 8, you know. My grandma and I thought he'd gone to Houston for a meeting. He never came home. A flash of pain cut across Miranda's pretty face. My annoyance with her dissipated like morning fog.
Dracobissus Torta broke up before he vanished, she stammered. And I thought maybe if he's, you know, if he's still out there and he thought someone was trying to start his old club again, then he'd come back to me. It's stupid, I know. She hung her head. I didn't know what to say. I had two adorable little siblings and parents who came home from work every night in time for family dinner. Miranda had her grandmother, a dead mom, and an unsolved mystery. I guess the website's harmless, I admitted. I don't think anyone's going to take it seriously. I fully intended to keep my pretty little nose out of Miranda's new game. She could cope with her dad's absence exactly how she needed to. I'd focus on baseball and planning for college. Except, that weekend, Kyle Watts called me. Hey man, it's been a while, I said airily, careful not to reveal the pure bliss his voice inspired. Sky. Christ, the way he said my name set me tingling. I got your email. You live in Pasadena now, right? You go to Morrison? Yeah, I replied. Well, technically I live in Arcadia, but yeah, I go to Morrison. How about you? St. Vincent, right? I think we were on the same message board, Kyle said. Huh? You know, he continued shyly. Dracobissus Torta, you're P.A. Kaunashi. You used that same name when we played Mortal Kombat in town. I'm Angels Fan 86. Of course, the chat room, Miranda's website. I did what you said, Kyle said. I looked up map coordinates, 34.32 and 118.01. It's the middle of the Angeles National Forest. Not sure what that means. I opened my mouth, prepared to explain everything to Kyle, to tell him the website, the riddle, and the entire recruitment angle was pulled out of thin air by a Morrison prep girl named Miranda Liddell. But if I tell him the truth, I thought, he won't have any reason to talk to me. It's an old campground, the Blue Turtle, I said instead. It closed a year ago after a fire. If you look at the message, not the rhyme, there's six letters in a different font than the rest. T-U-R-T-L-E. And the text is blue, not black. If you cut and paste it into Word, it's actually a really dark blue. Summer between sophomore and junior year, Miranda and I had gone camping with a few friends at the Blue Turtle campground. After s'mores and ghost stories around the fire, the two of us went off alone to try and hike to a waterfall we'd read about and got hopelessly lost. We never found that waterfall, but we did find a large, flat-topped boulder with a jagged fissure down the middle, up against the rock face of a cliff. The boulder was covered in colorful writing, painted or etched with marker. Names, scout troop numbers, hearts with initials, an occasional opinion about sucking dick. Miranda hoisted herself onto the face of the rock. She stared into the fissure and squealed with amusement. Hundreds, thousands of folded pieces of paper had been shoved into the crack. I climbed up beside her. We unfolded a handful of notes and read them out loud to each other in the moonlight. 5 years ago, I had an affair. Ray doesn't know Kimmy isn't his daughter. I stole my stepfather's car and crashed it. My brother got blamed. He went to juvie and came out an addict. I killed Lulu. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Some of the notes looked like they'd been there for years. We realized this was a confession rock of sorts. People wrote down their secrets and shoved them into the fissure. After his funeral, I started going through Jamie's computer. I found messages between him and an older man, a Dracobissus Torta recruiter. This recruiter told my son to drink antifreeze and suffocate himself with a belt. He said if he did, he'd be able to communicate with the Nephilim. They all say my son committed suicide. I call what that cult did to him murder. Linda J., bereaved mother, August 2018. You sure you know where you're going? Kyle asked. Trust me. It hadn't been difficult to find the Blue Turtle campground. I recognized the sign from the highway. Childish Huck Finn lettering with backwards R's and a homely cartoon turtle. We parked and left the hard, bare dirt of the campground for dry, bushy wilderness, heading awkwardly northwest, guided by Kyle's compass and the pulsating of my lizard brain, the muscle memory. It was late, and the woods were darker than I'd anticipated, but we'd brought flashlights. And, though my skin was scratched and itchy, bristles clung to my clothes, and unattractive rings of sweat formed under my arms, Kyle and I were having a really great time together. The trees thinned. We pushed past a hanging vine with purplish leaves and into a clearing. In front of us, the cliff face and a large rock with a jagged crack nearly cutting it in two. "Holy shit," Kyle said. The rock was just as I remembered. Graffiti coated every inch. "Cat was here," "Brownie Troop 519 2002, "Fuck Bush." The bottom was fuzzy with black fungal growth. "What do we do next?" Kyle asked. I was way ahead of him. I pulled a notebook out of my bag, tore off two pages, and procured two pens. I offered Kyle one of each. Then I vaulted up onto the flat top of the rock. "Come on," I said. "We've got to write a secret and put it in the crack. That's a thing people do here. Tell them a secret and they might reveal. The poem, remember?" Kyle smiled a goofy, childish smile. He climbed up and sat across from me. We were silent for a moment, scribbling. I wrote, "I know the crazy bitch who started this charade, but I'm not telling because I'm here with a hot guy." I folded up the note and shoved it deep into the fissure, my hand brushing against older secrets written on water-faded paper. I pulled my hand out as Kyle inserted his, and we brushed against each other. Electricity shot through my core. Kyle withdrew his hand quickly, throwing himself off balance. He lost his footing, slid, and tumbled into the narrow crevice between the stone and the cliff face. "Shit!" He groaned. A shuffling, and Kyle stood. The stone came to his sternum. His eyes were wide with wonder. "Man, you've got to see this," he said. I rolled over and lowered myself into the crevice beside him. My feet crunched against thorny brush and discarded beer cans. And then I saw what he had seen, painted onto the backside of the stone in hot pink. www.slut.bk.com, surrounded by pink rays like the sun. The paint looked fresh. "Of course it was me," Miranda confirmed, giggling on her beanbag chair. "Somebody I know had to go and tell the whole chat room the numbers are map coordinates. A couple of them figured it out and told all the other nerds." "A lot of scouts camped at the Blue Turtle campground," I said. "Wait, you're in the chat room?" Miranda snorted. "Boy, I started the chat room." I sat on her bed. "Well, the URL isn't real. It goes to 404 not found." "I own the domain," Miranda said. "I'll put up the website when I figure out another scavenger hunt for the message board dweebs." She grinned wickedly. "Skylar, you're telling me you went traipsing through the woods to find the painted rock. Did you happen to go there with a cute boy?" A happy little thrill bubbled up, but I didn't want to tell Miranda I was talking to Kyle. She knew all about our baseball camp kiss and that he'd broken my heart. If I told her I'd gone traipsing through the woods with the famous Kyle Watts, she'd spend the rest of the night lecturing me about it. "I went with my kid brother," I lied. "Now, can we just get ready for Kelsey's party?" Kelsey Wong's pool party was a dud. We ran out of booze 45 minutes in, the hot tub didn't work, there were too many people and no space to dance, and Kelsey's playlist included an unpalatable amount of country. Miranda kept herself busy, kicking Tom Rivera's ass at beer pong. I drank a cup of shitty beer, ate half a weed brownie, and escaped to my car. I'd stashed Miranda's father's journal in my glove compartment. She'd given it to me, but I hadn't sat down and actually read it yet. I turned on my overhead light, leaned back in the driver's seat, and opened the leather-bound book. The secrets of a vanished cult leader seemed much more interesting than 100 teenagers grinding against each other in a tiny suburban backyard. Jake Liddell, Miranda's father, was a real piece of work. He barely mentioned his dead wife or his little daughter. Instead, he wrote page after page of nonsensical chants and rhymes, apparently spells to contact and mind-meld with the Nephilim. The Nephilim, he wrote, were the hybrid children of angels and men. They'd been banished to a barren plain by the archangels, from which the Nephilim commandeered the bodies of the Dracopisces Torta initiates. They craved human experiences. Food, drink, lovemaking, rain on their faces. But they also had a taste for some messed up shit. Murder, bestiality, arson, torture. Jake described the Dracopisces Torta rituals in great detail. He also detailed, gleefully, the abuse inflicted upon those seen as traitors to the cult. Ever see the Museum of Torture at the Renaissance Fair? Yeah, think along those lines. And his most virulent vitriol was reserved for those who defected and tried to form their own groups to use Dracopisces Torta teachings for their own benefit. In the end, Jake's writings devolved into nonsense. He'd given too much of himself to the Nephilim. He'd driven himself mad. At 11 the next morning, I was jolted awake from an inebriated slumber by my ringing cell phone. I heard Kyle's voice.
Skyler!
He squealed excitedly.
I tried the URL again, the one we found at the campground, and it's there! A new message from Dracopisces Torta!
The slut of the false world has my journal. My journal has my spells. My spells connect me to the Nephilim. If you retrieve my journal from the slut of the false world, you will gain the power to meet the Nephilim. In the slut of the false world's tower of stone, the bearded savior waits all alone. In the green room, tears roll down his pretty girl's face until the shepherd climbs the red tree and he can escape. Below the rhyme, there was a new, much more aesthetically pleasing sketch. A pretty white dragon with big gray eyes encircled a foreboding tower made of stone and a tree with red flowers. I was still staring at the website, Dracopisces Torta's second rhyming clue, hours later, when a frantic Miranda called.
I didn't do it, Skyler! I didn't create that website!
Her voice was high-pitched, grating, with a hint of a child's tantrum hanging around the edges. What do you mean it wasn't you? I asked. You own the domain name.
Someone hijacked my website is what I mean!
She screeched. And wrote a new riddle for Dracopisces Torta? Who'd do that? I knew the answer. I'm sure she knew the answer. I recalled Jake Liddell's writing, the journal I'd read the night before. The rituals, the violent possession by an otherworldly force, the horrific pain inflicted on those perceived as taking what rightfully belonged to Dracopisces Torta. The answer is the Good Shepherd Church, you know, I said. Miranda gasped squeakily. It's got that obelisk in front that looks like stacked rocks. There's a big poinsettia tree in the lawn. You told me about your old Sunday school classroom there, androgynous Jesus, and that your dad and you left...
Because the minister's wife called my mother a slut, Miranda finished. You don't think...
Yeah, I thought. I thought Miranda caught what she'd been fishing for. Daddy was back in town.
I was part of Dracopisces Torta for a few years. I could never catch the Nephilim or whatever. The whole thing was a bunch of BS, if you ask me. And the guys that brought me in, they'd brag about all the stuff they got up to with the Nephilim, like beating dudes, beheading cats and crap. And I thought it was real messed up, so I went to the cops. And then Dracopisces Torta found out that I'd snitched. They locked me in a basement, naked. No food, just a bucket so I could drink my own piss. They'd beat me. Then the master came in with his toolbox and... I'm going to have the scars the rest of my life. He kept on telling me that the Nephilim were excited by my screams. Like, sexually excited. They would have killed me. The only reason they didn't was because my sister made too much noise with the police and the master got cold feet.
Katrina S., former Dracopisces Torta member, July 2021.
Draco Bissus Torta was getting hot. Miranda's initial website, the one with the first riddle, had clocked over 3,000 views. The second surpassed 5,000. The chat room filled with new people typing a message per second, and as I walked to the science lab at school on Tuesday, I was sure I overheard two sophomores whispering about summoning Nephilim. On Friday, Kyle called me. I knew staying involved was not a good idea. Whoever posted that second website and the second clue, they'd terrified Miranda. She'd been uncharacteristically quiet at school. There were dark circles under her eyes, and she hadn't bothered to put on makeup. And if Jake Liddell had truly returned from the void to reclaim his place on the throne of Draco Bissus Torta, well, I'd read his journal. Jake Liddell was depraved. But then, Kyle called, and I gave in. I told him I'd solved the second clue. The answers we sought could be found in the Sunday school classroom of a Presbyterian church. His voice went low like the purr of a cat. I was a genius, he told me. And since our adventure at the Blue Turtle campground, he hadn't been able to stop thinking about me. We made plans to break in the next Friday night. Kyle looked ridiculously attractive when we met outside the Good Shepherd Church, dressed in a beanie and a black t-shirt that accentuated his toned arms. The church wasn't difficult to break into. 2 minutes with my lockpick later, I had the broad oak doors open, and we walked together into the quiet nave. I wasn't as familiar with the church as Miranda, but my younger siblings attended the attached elementary school, so I could find my way around. We turned on our flashlights. I led Kyle through the hallway between the pews, then into an alcove and past the back offices, before we came to the green door of the Sunday school classroom. On display were dozens of rambunctiously crayoned images torn from biblical coloring books and construction paper angels with cotton ball wings mounted on a blue background labeled Heaven. Right behind the teacher's desk, a bearded but distinctly feminine cartoon Jesus perched, surrounded by a crowd of racially integrated children. Kyle gasped. Holy shit! You were right, man! Holy shit! On the well-used whiteboard, a message had been written in bright red marker. The Painted Rock, Midnight, Sunday. Below the message, a drawing of the now familiar tower with the dragon wrapped around it. Kyle pulled his Canon PowerShot out of his bag and snapped a picture. Then he turned to me, eyes wide and wild. Did we make it? Did we solve the puzzle and, like, get accepted to Draco Bissus Torta? I don't know, I said. I guess we need to go back to the Blue Turtle campground and to that same rock to find out. Kyle's handsome face broke into a goofy smile. He threw his arms around my neck. I hugged him tightly, breathing in his gym sweat and body spray smell. He pulled back. Then, he leaned in and kissed me. He tasted like the mint Altoids he always carried. Tap to tap. I let go of Kyle. He pouted like a kicked puppy. Did you not want to... Shh, I whispered. I think someone else is... Tap to tap. To tap, tap, tap. We both froze. Coordinated thuds echoed through the church, like a whole crowd of people rhythmically tapping their feet against the hard concrete floor of the nave. Kyle and I glanced at each other. Time to go. I turned out the lights in the classroom. Then, side by side, we flipped off our flashlights and made our way back to the front of the church, our way illuminated by moonlight through the large windows of the nave. I think we both tried to convince ourselves we'd been busted by the local Pasadena PD, that we weren't in any real danger. We emerged in the nave. A shadow moved. Then another. Kyle yelped and grasped my hand. Tap to tap, to tap, tap, tap. And then they were everywhere, emerging from every dark corner, figures in floor-length black robes. In unison, they took a step. They blocked the front door, blocked every window and corridor that could have been a means of escape. There were at least 30 of them, every face obscured by heavy hood, like an army of grim reapers. Tap to tap. To tap, tap, tap. The hooded army took another step. My blood froze in my veins. every dark figure clutched a knife, an axe, or a length of rope in a black-gloved hand.
"What do we do?"
Kyle hissed into my ear. Quietly, I led him back into the church office. I pointed to a black door.
"This way."
Hand in hand, we slipped through the door. It led to a narrow stairway, which led to the high catwalk surrounding the nave, a wispy walkway jutting out from the wall, encircled by a waist-high rail before a 30-foot drop. The catwalk was used to adjust lights and hang decorations, and by kids dressed like baby angels during the Christmas program. We could sneak around, crawl, then climb through a window and down the fire escape at the back end. Kyle and I clung to each other. We risked a look down. The robed figures stood still as statues, weapons glinting in the moonlight. Every single hooded, invisible face was turned towards us. Then, rough hands clutched my arms. I twisted and struggled, caught sight of Kyle, and let loose a scream. A gloved hand covered his mouth, another pinned his arms behind his back. His attacker, a huge man who towered over Kyle's 6-foot-1 form, wore the same black robe as the crowd below. His face, however, was uncovered. He looked around 50, ugly and balding, with a large scar cutting from forehead to chin.
"Leave him alone!"
I screamed. Slam! Pain exploded from my nose and stars burst in front of my eyes. My captor swung me around, blood trickling down my chin. I tasted copper. There was a sharp twinge in my mouth, an odd sensation of fullness. I spat out blood and a tooth. The balding maniac grinned psychotically.
"The Nephilim don't like amateurs," he growled in a deep, menacing tone.
Then there were more gloved hands grasping for us, more figures emerging from the shadows behind the huge, balding man. The hands lifted Kyle.
"No!"
I gurgled. They hoisted him up high, higher than the railing. Then they let go. I heard Kyle's desperate screams. Then the sickening thud. I kicked and punched and fought. The hands released me. I stumbled back, turned, and was allowed my first glimpse at my own attacker. Another tall man. He looked to be in his early 40s, and he was beautiful. He had a full head of ice blonde hair, a square jaw, and expressive gray eyes. He smiled at me, a Mona Lisa smile, a smile that reminded me of Miranda, I whispered. "You're her father."
"You have something that belongs to me," Jake Liddell said.
"The journal. Fuck." I can't recount exactly how I got away from Jake Liddell and his army of robed sociopaths. The details have been sucked into a black spot in my hippocampus where traumatic memories are buried. I kicked, clawed, swung my flashlight like a baseball bat, clambered down the fire escape like a demented monkey, ran until my lungs threatened to burst, and then I was flying east on the 210 freeway, my car swerving in and out of empty lanes. I hid in my room for hours, coughing up blood and crying my eyes raw for Kyle. It's all my fault. I was the one who'd brought him to the church. I read Jake Liddell's journal, and I should have known how dangerous he could be. Now I needed to alert the authorities. Scout's honor, I would have called the police. I turned on my computer. I had 28 emails from my friends. A strange new video had been posted on YouTube, then the hot new thing we were all obsessed with. The video showed Miranda sitting in her room, speaking into her grandmother's camcorder. She must have uploaded the video from school using the tape deck in the media office. She wore a stained old Sports Day t-shirt.
"This is a confession," Miranda started, tears leaking from her puffy eyes. "Draco Bisistorta isn't real. I made them up. I made it all up. I'm the one who posted that website online, the one with the riddle.
I wrote the riddle myself. I started the chat room. I shared the website with a few online friends I'd never met in real life, and I swear I never meant for it to get so big. I didn't even mean for people to solve the riddle. I had no idea that painted rock in the old Blue Turtle campground was so popular. I burned all the secrets you guys put there. I promise.
She took a breath. She was trembling.
I just wanted to say I'm so, so sorry. This all started as a joke. But now people are going too far, and someone else put up another website. And it needs to end before anyone gets hurt.
Miranda's grandmother was gone when I arrived at her house. The front door was locked, but I knew where she kept the hide-a key. Miranda lay curled up on her beanbag chair, dressed in the same old sports day t-shirt and sweats, hair tangled, face puffy and red.
"We need to talk," I said.
Miranda yelped and jerked, sliding off the beanbag and into an awkward position on the floor.
"Oh, Skylar,"
she stammered. She pulled herself upright.
"I know you saw the video,"
she croaked out before I could get a word out.
"This is getting really messed up, Skylar. Someone in the chat room started a rumor I'm the slut of the false world. And now people are sending me messages. Scary messages. They figured out where I live, and they're threatening to come and kill me. So I made the video to..."
"I met your dad," I cut in. Miranda's jaw fell slack. Her gray eyes darkened.
"That's impossible," she said.
"You were right," I said. "He's still alive. He came to the church with a bunch of his followers.
He killed Kyle." I suppressed a sob. "And I think he wants his journal, but I didn't give it to him. I have it here. I..."
"Skylar!"
Miranda's voice was a hysterical squeal.
"My dad is dead!"
"No, he's not," I insisted. "That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I wrote the journal. I wrote it myself."
That shut me up. Miranda shook like a tire swing in an earthquake.
My dad ran off when I was 8, Miranda stammered. "When I was 10, my grandmother flew to Texas to identify his body. He'd overdosed. He was never a physicist or the head of some magical secret society. Draco Bissus Torta doesn't exist. I'm the one who wrote the journal. It started as a creative writing project, then it just..."
"You lied to me," I finished. Miranda sniffled, blew a snot bubble.
"I thought if I could fool you, my best friend, I could fool anyone. And I didn't post that second webpage with the second riddle. Someone else did. I swear, I'm not lying about that. I'm not."
Her voice broke as she collapsed into sobs. She resembled a hairless rat, her face pink and snot-stained. For the first time, I saw Miranda clearly. She wasn't a brilliant, beautiful, shining star. She wasn't some enigmatic mastermind. She was a bratty teenage girl with daddy issues who sought attention by telling ridiculous lies.
"I'm leaving," I said, disgusted.
"No!"
Miranda jumped to her feet and clasped my arm.
"Please, please don't leave me alone. I'm so scared."
I wrung her off me like she were a bug. "If you're scared, call the police."
"I can't."
Miranda's wet face glistened.
"I'm waiting for Bob Gibbs. I messaged him. I told him I'd tell the cops about the naked pictures if he didn't bring me $10,000 tonight. He's coming now."
She cast down her eyes in shame. I snorted.
"So you're blackmailing the AIM creep," I mocked.
"And I'm your bodyguard."
"Please,"
Miranda sniffled.
"As soon as I get the money, I'll leave town. Forever. You'll never see me again."
I stayed. She looked that pathetic. At 2 in the morning, I was awakened by a woman's scream. I leapt off the couch in Miranda's living room. I heard loud footsteps, the slam of the front door.
I turned on my flashlight, clutched my baseball bat, and climbed the stairs to Miranda's room. The walls, the bed, the computer, and her favorite painting were all splattered with blood.
Crap, I don't like talking about this. He had a name, you know. It was Lewis. They keep on calling him the homeless man like he didn't even matter. Lewis had his mental struggles, but he was always kind. He fed birds at the park. And the way we found him, I still have dreams about it. Doused with oil, set on fire, left for civilians to find. And behind him, spray-painted onto a brick wall, that tower with a dragon twisting around it. Draco Bissus Torta, an L.A. cult, right? All of a sudden, they're here, too. Officer A. Riley, Philadelphia PD, September 2024. Miranda Liddell, aged 17, was pronounced dead on her bedroom floor. She'd been stabbed 27 times. The next morning, a church janitor discovered the body of Kyle Watts, also 17, in the nave of the Good Shepherd Church. He'd fallen to his death from a slender catwalk 35 feet up in the air. A man named Bob Gibbs, the president of the Good Shepherd Church, was arrested for Miranda's murder. The devout, married father had a perverted predisposition for teenage girls. Naked photos of Miranda were found on Gibbs' computer, as well as a library of similar goodies. The night of her death, she'd attempted to blackmail him for $10,000. His cell phone bounced off a tower near her grandmother's house. The infamous second website of the Draco Bissus Torta hoax, the one Miranda did not admit to creating, had been published from an internet cafe near his church. It was theorized Gibbs started the website to lure Miranda alone to the Good Shepherd Church. When a teenage boy, Kyle, appeared instead, Gibbs, furious, killed him. The police could never gather enough evidence to charge Gibbs with Kyle's death, but in the eyes of the public, he had the blood of both teenagers on his hands. He pled guilty to the second-degree murder of Miranda. He was just released from prison last year. I'm not worried about Bob Gibbs. Miranda liked to lie on the internet. I, however, prefer lying right to your face. While Miranda was in the bathroom, I stole all the information for the second website, www.slut-bk.com. I built the site myself in that internet cafe. I wrote the poem. I snuck into Good Shepherd hours before I broke in with Kyle, scribbled a message on the whiteboard in the Sunday school classroom. I wanted Kyle. I wanted him to love me back. And if Draco Bissus Torta went away, Kyle would abandon me again. That night at the church, I convinced him to climb up to the catwalk with me. You can see the most beautiful view of the mountains through the high windows. As we stared at the full moon, nearly touching, faces close, I risked it. I pulled Kyle in for a kiss. He kissed me back, warm hands caressing my body. But then he shoved me away. I fell, breaking a tooth. He wasn't like that anymore, he insisted. He'd only called me because he bet his baseball teammates he'd solve the Draco Bissus Torta mystery before they could. I meant nothing to him. Some days, I can convince myself he tripped, that his death was an unfortunate accident. But who am I kidding? I pushed Kyle over that railing. I watched his handsome face warp in terror, his tight body contort, blood explode from his head as he hit the concrete, pooling around his tousled auburn hair. I also started the rumor on the message board that Miranda Liddell was the slut of the false world. I didn't mean for her to get death threats. I just wanted to teach her a lesson, scare her a bit. Oh, I always knew Miranda wrote that journal she said was her dad's. She was tricky with her handwriting,
but she overused the word eldritch, a word I'd heard no one but Miranda ever say, and she always misspelled it. That gave her away. In the decades since Miranda's death, Draco Bissus Torta has been connected officially to 18 murders, unofficially as many as 50. Group members have infiltrated Reddit communities and online gaming forums. Others troll bars and other places lost young people go to find themselves. Draco Bissus Torta initiates have been implicated in animal torture, encouraging suicides, violent attacks on the homeless, and a number of sexual assaults. And they do it all, they say, for the Nephilim. Part of this is Miranda's fault. Part of it is mine. Because that night, I saw Miranda's murderers, and Bob Gibbs wasn't among them. It was a trio of kids I knew. Brett Walensky, who went to my school, Amber Yen, my friend from art class, and a St. Vincent boy I'd seen at a couple parties. They clutched a knife, each. Blood spatter stained their clothes and their animalistic faces. I was too shocked to even raise my baseball bat. Before my muscles caught up with my racing thoughts, Brett had his father's handgun pointed at my head. "The journal, asshole," he seethed. "The slut of the false world has my journal. I'd written that." I let Brett and the others lead me downstairs at gunpoint, away from Miranda's blood-stained body. I uncovered the leather-bound book, Jake Liddell's fake journal. "Draco Bissus Torta isn't real," I told the trio of murderers. "The journal isn't real. Miranda wrote it." "You're lying," Amber snarled virulently. Brett gestured threateningly with the gun. "We saw the video. The great slut is a liar, and she needed to die." I saw it in their eyes. Draco Bissus Torta was real, to them. They believed in secret clues and esoteric spells and that they could commune with the Nephilim. Nothing I could say would convince them that they'd been had, that their brand new belief system was an illusion, and I doubted they were the only ones. The St. Vincent kid snatched the journal from my hands with a sneer. "Draco Bissus Torta is going to be real," he said. "We'll make sure it is." You've just heard Miranda Liked to Lie on the Internet by Nikki Exposito. Nikki Exposito is a psychiatric nurse by day and a horror writer by night. Born and raised in Southern California, she's currently churning out tales of weird creatures and twisted realities from a tiny apartment in Brooklyn. Nikki can usually be found scrounging for coffee, bartending at weddings, or else wandering the streets of New York City, stringing together plot lines for her next story. Her work can be found on Reddit under username Nikki_XX. Her story, The Burned Photo, was produced as a podcast by Q Code Media. Oh, the internet. Such an amazing, wonderful tool, and with such limitless potential to corrupt. It's easy for me to focus on the internet of today, a nightmare of social media, political agendas, and swindlers, but it's sort of eye-opening to remember that things had just as much potential to be abused back in the good old days of Homestar Runner and E-Bombs world. But hey, it also lets all of you fine folks hear my voice every week, and without the hassle of me slipping into your homes through open windows. I'd like to thank both Craig Groshek and Nikki Exposito for their stories tonight. I'll be back next week with more chilling tales to get you through those dark nights, so be sure to tune in at the same day and time. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley.
Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.